Good. I'd like to say a few things to our topic, stillness of mind, pacification of mind, or quietening the mind. And for that, it seems important to refer to what you have, the beautiful word mindfulness in the English language. Huh? Mindfulness is an interesting concept. And after years of trying to convey the importance of mindfulness to people who are not necessarily Buddhist, I am now feeling a bit defensive about mindfulness, because mindfulness is now largely defined by people who are not necessarily Buddhists. Yeah? And it's an English word. Yeah, it's an old English word. I found it in a 16th century English dictionary of the French word pensée. Yeah? So, for many years I thought it was a Buddhist scholar who invented the word. That's what I thought. In fact, I've written about this, and so much so for the truth of that. And I found out, actually, although it wasn't used very much, it did actually exist, hundreds of years. Yeah? And in the late 19th century, the Welsh scholar Rhys Davids used that word to translate a key concept of Buddhist psychology called sati. I don't know whether he dug it up in Paul Scrave's French dictionary, but he may have read it in the Bible, because in the Bible the adjective mindful occurs, which would lead me into a long footnote on the Hebrew roots of this. But as the term, speaking of care, of circumspection, of a particular presence of mind. And I think the English word mindfulness does a very good job at conveying some of the depth and the breadth of that Buddhist key concept. Mr. Rhys Davids, 120 years ago, translated with mindfulness. Yeah. And the word sati, as some of you know, is crucial for Buddhist meditation. It is crucial both for the insight part of meditation, it is crucial both for the stillness part of meditation. And the word sati means rather more than some of the cognitive psychologists like us to believe what it really means. In Buddhist psychology, it means a whole range of things. Yeah? It means the capacity to attend. That's one aspect. But it means the capacity to attend in a very particular way. Buddhist psychology distinguishes mindfulness or sati from plain attention. Now, there are different terms for that. So it's more than just attention. Yeah? Sort of in a household way, we have started using mindfulness as if it was a type of attention, or as if the two were synonymous. This is to some extent true, but if we insist that this is the only truth about it, then we lose a lot of the halo of sati. We lose a lot of its nuances, and we lose a lot of its... it has over and undertones. If we look at the Buddhist teaching, we see that the term sati is conveyed in lists. Many famous lists contain the term sati. The Eightfold Path contains the term sati. The Awakening Factors contain the term sati. There are many such lists. But maybe more telling than lists, because lists are tricky, you see. You need to have a definition. If you want to make use of a list, you need to have clear definitions. And clear definitions are not so easy. They're not so easy in a contemporary language. And when a term travels more than 2,500 years and crosses over half of the globe, chances are that to understand a clean definition, you need to do a lot of translating. Not just translating of a term, but of a context. Yeah. And I think any translation of the term sati is likely to lose some of the depth of that original notion. Now, if we look at the images, it is quite interesting because the images often travel more lightly through the cultures and the millennia, yeah? Because an image speaks to a different part of our mind than a definition. So if we look at the images in the Buddhist teachings that are used to convey what sati does, we find some images speak of a spacious awareness. Man climbing on a tower looking down, or a charioteer sitting on his seat looking out to his animals, to the road, to the freight on his cart, to what happens with the other people on his bench. Yeah? So sort of circumspectious, so if there is such a word, circumspective, a notion of something, a scanning, vigilant kind of awareness that is not locked into one aspect, but that moves and is capable of holding various bits in perspective. Yeah, various bits. That's what you need for driving a car. Yeah, driving a car, you don't want full-fledged absorptive samadhi. You know, just gonna ignition key. Start turning. Yeah, there you're gone. Yeah, for driving a car or raising kids or doing shopping, basically you need a sort of a mobile scanning type of awareness, which is applicable, which can get more than one bit on the screen. Yeah, which can gauge which bit needs more awareness right now than which other bit. Yeah, there's something other going on with a sort of scanning, peripheral, mobile awareness than with a full lock-on, absorptive, concentration type state. You see, this is a different. These are two very different things. So, sati is, in other images, depicted as that which protects. Yeah, a gatekeeper, front of the city. Letting in only those people he knows that belong to the city, and the other he inspects. Yeah, and some of them he turns away. Sati standing there, basically screening. Yeah? So, and what we are told is that as the gatekeeper keeps those people out, he feels do not belong to the city and have no good reasons to go in there. So, sati watches over the heart, for that only wholesome impulses may enter the heart. The unwholesome ones are turned away. That sounds somewhat different than, say, non-judgmental awareness, isn't it? For the MBSR, MBCT people amongst you. Sati is described in a very stark image as a medical instrument. A man comes wounded, his friends bring him, he has an arrow wound. In fact, the text insists it's a poisoned arrow wound. And they bring him to a surgeon, and the surgeon makes a little incision in the wound because the arrowhead has disappeared, the shaft is removed, and he doesn't see that arrowhead. So he makes a tiny incision and then uses an instrument which you might call a probe in English, yeah? And with that probe, which has a soft tipped end, it goes into the wound to ascertain the size, the placement, and the contours of that arrow hair head sunk in the man's flesh. Yeah? And with that probe, he finds out how big, where exactly, and in what shape that thing is. And with that knowledge then, our man makes an incision, precise and minimally invasive, and removes the arrowhead. The sati is likened to that probe that is inserted to ascertain, to test out, to probe out, to fathom the placement and the size of that arrowhead. A very interesting image, yeah? Again, it's not non-judgmental, non-entangled. It engages. It goes in. It tries to... It probes, yeah? I think quite literally. There is a curious investigative quality to sati at that stage. Yet another image, very different. I'm just picking the ones most starkly different. There are, for each of those applications, there are generally a couple more. One image that covers an aspect which we have not spoken much of is there's a huge post sunk into the ground, and to that post are tied six wild animals. Each of those animals is chained firmly to that post, and the animals are pretty upset. They're wild, making noises, movements, and the post stays firm, yeah, immobile, sunk into the ground. And the animals tire themselves out, and gradually start kind of trotting around rather than running. The noises become more placid, and finally they kind of sit or lie down, and put their heads down. Yeah. And the pillar allows that to happen. The pillar is sati. The wild animals are the senses, yeah, our sense faculties, which are continually prodded, impinged upon our gateways through which our mindfulness disperses itself into the world. And with the help of a stabilizing, firm sati, these wild animals can be pacified and become docile. And yet another instance, sati is likened again to a gatekeeper, but this time in a totally different role. The gatekeeper stands outside awaiting two messengers, two important messengers. The messengers, by the way, are called samatha and vipassana. Yeah? So the messengers bring their accurate and true message. And so that these messengers don't get lost in the city, in the maze of little alleyways and market stalls and such like, our gatekeeper has the job to bring them straight to the lord of the city in the most direct and the most efficient way. Yeah. So sati quite clearly in the job of efficiency, yeah, of dare I say it, of economy. Yeah. So the most economical way of going about something, that's the task sati has to perform with these two messengers who have to bring their important message to the mayor of the city. So, what aspect of sati is most important for stillness meditation? I think the obvious one is the one with the pillar. Yeah. If you look at the investigative quality of mindfulness, of which, to be true, truthfully telling you, the vipassana, insight meditation, is only a continuation of that initial investigative quality, which is already in the seed of mindfulness, you see? Mindfulness holds both the seed for the stillness and for the understanding of mind. Yeah. So both for this vipassana aspect of practice and the samatha aspect of practice, they lay dormant, basically, in the shade of functions mindfulness has. Yeah. Now, if we favor the insight vipassana practice aspect, then we're interested in basically establishing a type of mindfulness that is capable of noting and following, yeah, noting what's happening and following that, noting and following with one thing, a sound, and say a sound till the sound ends. Normally we would be attentive of the sound until we recognize it, and then we have a name for the sound, and then we associate discursively from the name of the sound a little story, you know? I hear a sound, and then I think, oh, this is a boy, this is football, he seems happy, And then I think of happy boys and football and blah, blah, blah. It goes this way, yeah? If I am mindful of the sound, I stay with the sound. Even if the mind pops up the idea, oh, this is a boy, this is football, I go back to the sound. I stick with the sound till the sound disappears. Yeah. So the first task, and say, inside practice is I learn to identify an object and to stay with that object till it peters out, till it goes away. And I refrain from discursively taking up the theme, boy, football, Saturday afternoon, Hampstead, you know, whatever the theme might be. I stay with the sensory impingement and its arising, its change, its disappearance. That would be the task. And I learned to do that. And then later I might, at some later stage, I might investigate my attitude to little kids, to football, to Hampstead, yeah? I might investigate that and see whether I have particular strong feelings about these things or why I have these feelings, or I may acknowledge the physical effects that has or the emotional effects that has. I may work that out. In terms of samatha, of stillness practice, all this is not really interesting. Samatha practice makes use of the mindfulness only the stillness aspect. When we try to still the mind, we have delineated very clearly an area of our experience which we name our primary object. Yeah? This is our exercise. And all the rest is basically a distraction. Your whole life, a distraction. All your glorious ideas, a distraction. All your 50 years of experience, a distraction. All the open wild life awaiting you out there, once you finally get out here, a distraction. Yeah? You go back to your task. You go back to bringing the mind to what you have decided is your task. Say a touch sensation in your belly and staying with that sensation. Throughout the football, the boys, you know, the turning of the globe, all the thoughts arising and passing, sleepiness, alertness, whatever, you stay with that experience. That is your task. And you have plan A. Plan A says, this is my task. Plan B says, when I'm not on my task, I go back there. Plan B is very, very important. You don't try to do metta, you don't try to do vipassana, you don't try to kind of get the discriminative knowledges, or you don't worry about the 18th of the jnanas. You just go back to what you have decided is your exercise, and you do that again and again and again. You do it gently, you do it softly, you do it precisely, and the amount of will you use is directed in bringing you back. It's not in trying to make that point harder or more fixated or more. You don't try to concentrate your mind. You try to give your mind something it likes to concentrate on, and then you keep bringing it back there. Yeah, like you take a child by the hand, a child that kind of runs here and runs there, and you say, come look here, come back here. Yeah, and you bring it back there, and after a while you will notice it doesn't run away that much. After a while you will notice it'll actually like being there. It starts enjoying being there. Yeah? And you keep bringing it back, bringing it back, bringing it back. And that is a very simple, albeit not easy, task to make the mind more familiar with that aspect of your experience you have decided is your exercise. Yeah? You become more intimate with your breath. You become more intimate with the movements of your mind away from that breath. You become more intimate along the way, inevitably. So that means you will have insights into what's happening for you and in your life, even if you try not to have any insights. Even if you only try to still your mind, you will inevitably meet your habit patterns. You will inevitably meet your distractibility. You will inevitably meet all the things you find offensive for. Yeah. So it's crucial that you understand the differing aspects of sati, of mindfulness. Now, there is an aspect that is spacious, wide and open. And there's an aspect that is firm and stable and planted.
Yeah.
And both have something to do with the quality the Buddha named sati. It's the sati in satipatthana, it's the sati in anapanasati. It means bringing the fullness of my mind's capacities to one task. Now it doesn't say, I only do that if it works. Yeah. It doesn't say, I do it 10 minutes and then that's good enough. It doesn't say, I do it on some days and on other days I just do whatever I feel like. Yeah. It doesn't say that. Samatha practice does not easily take to that type of attitude. Samatha practice is, it needs quite a bit of dedication. You know, there is a voluntary simplicity in that activity that goes utterly against the grain. And if you have not met that part in you that rebels against that, then I don't think you have started yet, to be honest. Yeah. And yet, at the same time, if you actually give yourself the heart, you know, and go that extra bit, you will notice that it is possible that your mind actually starts enjoying this and starts staying and actually starts, believe it or not, becoming really quiet. And this is magic. Yeah. There is some profound magic there, because it's like having a brick wall painted. Yeah. Once you have put your finger through there and you know it's just painted, yeah, it's not real brick, you will never quite believe in brick walls anymore. Yeah. However convincing it may look in the future, you will know, bah, it's just printed paper. And you will know underneath all that noise, underneath all that frantic cognitive activity, if I just stay with my breath in the belly for 15 minutes, it gets calm. It doesn't say it gets calm, it says it gets never calm. That's what it says, in fact. It feels like it would never. It doesn't want to be calm. It says, believe me, I'm important, do something, don't just sit here. Yeah. And if you don't believe it, if you don't do something with it, and you just go back, it will become quiet. It may not be jhanic, it may not be absorptive quiet, but it will become more quiet. And the magic is not how deep it goes. The magic is that you have a say in what state you're in. The magic lies therein that you can actually alter your being. You can alter your mode of being. Because if you can do that much, there is no reason why you can do that much. You see? And you will never quite believe that what you actually experience as the state of your mind as an absolute truth. You will never quite believe that anymore. Now, this is very powerful. It doesn't mean that you will never again get frantic, that you never again get angry, that you never again can lose your head. But it means when you notice that you have just lost your head, it'll probably take a lot less time to go back to quiet. And that in itself is kind of quite inspiring. You know? I can goof off, but I can come back. You know? I know when I goof off and I know how to come back. That is very, very powerful. In terms of developmental psychology, you probably know that some of the things that are most important for our learning as human beings, it's how we cope with fear.
Yeah.
The things that help us to downregulate fear are some of the most powerfully impacting experiences we have in our lives. So how I can downregulate my or downmodulate my anxiety is a very formative experience. Yeah. Meditation may be very useful in this. It takes a degree of discernment, because there is, contrary to popular belief, stillness meditation is not having an iron grip on your mind, or the capacity to just kind of, you know, split heaven and earth asunder with your with the power of your sharp katana mind or something like that. This is myth, you know, I mean false myth in that. It is the capacity to basically be able to ascertain what's happening. You know? So a simple orientation skill. How crazy am I right now? Mm-hmm. How calm? How peaceful? How distracted? Is this anger? You know, to the degree we are capable of actually orienting within our state, we have very powerful tools at our fingertips to change these states, to alter them, to influence them. Maybe not at a finger snip, but if I know that I am angry, I can be more careful what I say. If I know that I'm tired, I'm sleepy and dopey, I can do something about it. I don't need to sheepishly wait till it's over, yeah, and thereby go into a sort of four-hour collapse or a 20-year displacement pattern or so. Yeah. I can actually do something about this. But it all hinges on my willingness and my capacity to acknowledge what takes place. Now, there's no way around this one. It's not about power. It's about honesty. And it's about skill. How can I meet myself? How willing I am to meet myself where I am, rather where I think I should be or where I deserve to be met. There is generally a considerable amount of resistance to a large chunk of our experience. Even our bodily experience. I alluded this morning something between the relationship between our wish to consume things and to be stimulated as a primarily a comfort rather than direct stimulus seeking. You know, most of the stuff we entertain ourselves with is not intrinsically entertaining. It is only insofar entertaining as it takes us away from a state which is somewhat less entertaining. Yeah? Yeah? It is not that I like the music, but I feel what I don't want to feel a little less when I listen to the music. I don't feel the boredom as much as I would feel it if I turned the radio off. You understand? Yeah, it's not intrinsically attractive to us. It is not our intrinsic seeking of stimulus, but it is the wish to displace something mildly unpleasant. Yeah. It's a profound aspect of the Buddha's teaching around dukkha. Because so much of our seeking or so much of our desire is not focused to honest, direct experience of pleasure. Yeah. Understanding enough, you know, feels good, tastes good, why shouldn't I have it? Yeah. But so much of desire is trying to get away from what is even boring, let alone mildly or pronouncedly unpleasant. Yeah. So much of our attentional and intentional movements are away movements rather than toward movement. I would say 3/4 of my toward movements are away movements, if I'm clear. Yeah. 3/4 of what I go towards are probably movements away from something I rather not have, rather not feel, rather not experience. Now, and this rather not have, rather not feel, rather not acknowledge is the biggest problem in practice. It's the biggest problem insofar that it hurts and we don't want it to hurt. It's totally counterintuitive if it hurts for me to actually direct my attention to that place. It's bad enough that it hurts. I don't want to give it my attention, you know, let alone be seen with this. You know, it's shameful. Or at least that may feel that way. So my habituated response to unpleasant experience, even mild forms of dukkha, is going away from. And that going away denies my possibility to transform this experience. You see? So my first enemy really is that part in me that doesn't want to have that experience. You've got a few real numbers in your language here. You say things like, we're not having this conversation. Yeah. That is the, you know, that is the quintessence of what I mean. You know, you are there with somebody in a conversation, and you suddenly conclude that we are not having this conversation. Yeah. Obviously, it's a communicative act. You know, it's, logically, it's a total joke to make such statements. But as an attitude, it's all too familiar. You know, we can completely identify with somebody just deciding that we are not right now having this conversation because I don't like it anymore. Yeah. Now, we do that a lot with large chunks of our somatic experience, of our mental, our emotional experience. And that is one of the things that stops us most transforming the very experience we don't want to have. You know, the quickest way out of that experience is in. That's the truth. Yeah. If you want to conserve an experience, freeze it. Repress it. Repressing is really effective. Yeah. You can live off repressed stuff. You know, I've seen 90-year-old people with grotesque physical conditions who were suffering from repressed sexual feelings. Yeah. Absolutely preposterous. A body who is about to die is, you know, flooded with what can only be repressed sexual material. Yeah. So the mind is capable of parking that stuff and conserving stuff if you have not enabled yourself to have it. Yeah. Mm-hmm. If you're determined enough to not think that thought again, you know, that's where not repression but suppression starts. Yeah. Now, our unwillingness to have the experience we are having is one of the major reasons why we keep having the experiences we don't want to have, to be blunt. Yeah. So some of the practice, like all other things in life, hinges on our capacity to acknowledge what actually takes place in our mind right now, where we are at, with ourselves. Once we do that, there are generally fairly effective tools that help us either to find stillness or to reel back from the senses or to bring up something wholesome or to change a slightly acidic sort of mind with the help of metta practice. There's generally a lot of tools once we have acknowledged what takes place. Rather than denying what takes place and fortifying our denial with the help of our meditative practice, you know, trying not to have it with the help of my samatha, trying to not have it, or trying to vipassana my way around to you, which kind of stares into my face. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Having metta for 1 billion Chinese over there, rather than for the guy who sits here with his nylon trouser that makes crinkly noise. So there are things which are very powerful helpers when it comes to stilling the mind. One of them I've just mentioned is metta. It is no secret that having a heart and a mind that is welcoming, that is interested, that is friendly, you know, that such a mind is much more easily to become still, much more easy to unify. Think of samatha not as concentration. Think of samatha as unification. Yeah. Generally, the word for the state is called samadhi. In Buddhist tradition, this is a non-defined depth of stillness of mind. In Vedic tradition, and particularly in Patanjali, this is a specific state of mind. But in Buddhist tradition, samadhi is basically any degree of collectedness, any degree of stillness of mind, of calm, while samatha is the practice that leads to such stillness. Yeah? Think, instead of concentration, think of unification. The image for samadhi is the image of water, the cohesive element in water. Yeah? This kind of coming together is the most powerful image for a mind that unifies. There are a couple of terms the Buddha uses to describe degrees of samadhi. One of them is ekodibhava, which means having become one. Yeah. Another one is ekagata, which means having become one-pointed. Now this is a fruit. You don't try to make your mind one-pointed. Yeah? You don't kind of... This is not the idea. Your will is not directed to make your mind collected. Your will is directed to stop your mind going to places where it loses energy, where it finds distraction. That's where your will is directed to. Let me give you a very simple image. This is from Ajahn Chah. And he says, and Ajahn Chah says, if you have a genuine water buffalo, you don't need to teach it how to eat grass. If it's a genuine buffalo, an authentic buffalo, it knows how to eat grass. Your job is to get it onto the right patch. Yeah. Water buffaloes, those of you who have had dealings with water buffaloes. Hackney Marshes are teeming with them, isn't it? Lovely animals. 600 kilos of muscles with nothing to prove. Great. Sweet, sweet lowing voices and gentle noses, but seductible, you know. So by neighbors' flowers, for example, by hedges, by patches which don't belong to the man whose water buffalo this is. So the task is to get the water buffalo onto the right rice paddy, the paddy that is harvested, and then, you know, the grass grows, and the water buffalo sits there, tied to a post with a long leash, and it can eat the whole day. So once it's all there, it knows exactly what to do. The difficult bit is getting it out there, you know, getting it past the hedges, past the flowers, past the neighbor's fields. You know. And sometimes you see this little Thai girl with a little twig, and sometimes a plastic string going through the water buffalo's nose. Yeah, from Thai girl has a water buffalo, string goes through the nose, and kind of water buffalo comes along. Little girl, big buffalo, no problem. Buffalo understands he has to go there. And the girl, it doesn't take, you know, an army battalion heavily armed to get that buffalo out there. It takes a little girl with a plastic leash and a little twig to help him get it out there. Yeah, that's an interesting proportion, maybe for the amount of will, yeah, necessary to lead. And then you bring the buffalo out. The analogy is you bring the buffalo past all the things you keep thinking about, past all the things that are not necessarily helpful right now, that you know are not actually helping you become more still or quiet or content, past all those things. And you keep helping that buffalo finding its patch, finding its meadow or its field where he can graze. Once there, let him graze. He will know how to graze. Your mind wants to be still. Your mind enjoys concentration. I bet. You don't need to convince it that this is nice, as little as you need to convince the buffalo how to eat or that he should eat grass. The important bit is getting there past all the tempting possibilities that keep knocking. Yeah? So, I have a question. I'd like to know how you know whether you're mindful or not. This is not a rhetorical question. I like real answers. I like them now. How do you know that you're mindful? Is this a feeling? Is this a state of mind? Do you gauge that by the speed of your thought, by the content of your thought, the amount of light in your inner heart? What is it that tells you that you're mindful? I'm curious, and I'm listening.
Sense of steadiness and groundedness.
Where?
In the body. So I feel quite solid in the body. It's quite grounded. Rather than when I'm not mindful, almost like my energy's up here and I'm kind of, it's almost like a move forward. So when I'm more mindful, I feel more upright and kind of a bit more rooted physically.
Mm-hmm. Which part of your body you check to find that out?
The stomach.
Uh-huh. Okay. Thank you. Other voices?
I've not really experienced it very much, but on the odd occasion that I have, it's been in the situation whereby I haven't reacted to a group of people or something happening. I've had the ability to stay a bit lower in myself and then to come back with something a bit calmer.
Uh-huh.
Yeah.
So...
And I thought that was mindfulness.
Yeah, that sounds like it. That sounds like it. So you felt you have more space or more time?
Yes, definitely.
To,
yeah. Yes, that's exactly what it is. Mm.
Okay, thank you.
I noticed what's going on. I was sitting in the lunch today thinking, the same thoughts are in my head today that were in my head yesterday. But I'm aware they're thoughts today that were yesterday. I'm getting exhausted.
Yesterday they were real, huh? Right, right. Very good point. Other voices. So noticing what's happening, yeah. Actually becoming what psychologists would call apperception, yeah. You're not. It's not just happening and it affects you, but actually you notice that it's happening and that it affects you. Yeah.
I had a medical investigation, something I've never had before. I thought I was present.
What?
And I don't know if this is mindfulness, but that's what comes to mind.
Well, it's an aspect of mindfulness. I would probably suspect it was a...
And I have to relax.
A sense of heightened vigilance, probably. Yeah.
I it was advised that I shouldn't contract.
Yeah. How did you notice that you have that state? How did you notice that?
How did I notice it?
Yeah. What told you that this is happening?
I was brought to that area of my body.
Yeah.
Which was being investigated upon.
Mm-hmm.
A part of my body which I just take for granted. But
yeah.
At that particular time, I had to be fully aware of that
okay.
part.
And you noticed an unusual state of alertness, or?
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Was that calm, or was that more anxious?
It wasn't so much anxious, because I knew that if I contracted,
yeah,
it would make things very difficult for me.
Right, okay.
So I had to, uh-huh. I don't know if it's relaxation, but I had to, I knew I didn't have, I couldn't contract.
Yeah.
If I contracted, it would make things very painful.
Yeah. Yeah, that is an aspect of mindfulness. It's the vigilant aspect, the kind of tinged with probably a particular kind of alertness, you know.
Mm.
Thank you.
A passive alertness.
Yeah.
It was a passive type of alertness.
Mm.
It had to be.
Yes, yes. Sometimes we only do it when it has to be, isn't it? Other voices. Please.
When you remember, when you realise that you haven't been mindful.
Okay, so the bit that tells you that you've...
When you realise that you snap out of it.
I'm glad you're saying that, because that's generally... You know, you could look at that part and say, failure again. You could interpret that part as basically being the proof that you're not mindful. But in fact, it's the beginning of mindfulness again. Because it's mindfulness that acknowledges that you're no longer... that you haven't been mindful up to now. Please.
It's when you breathe, and you can sense the temperature of the air coming in.
Uh-huh. Where do you sense that?
In the nose.
So, you know that when you can gauge the temperature of the incoming air...
It's not like I have a number in my head.
Yeah, no.
Not that mindful, but it's when you sort of... When you're aware of the difference in temperatures between the outside air and your body, I guess. Just really simple.
Yes, that's very precise and very accurate, because temperature sensations are very, very primary. They tell you very early. You're very in your body when you do that. Excellent.
Isn't that a perception of the sense, surely?
Well, yes, but obviously you're aware of it. The interesting bit is not the perception of the sense, but the fact that you are aware of it. You know, you have all the time sense perceptions. But most of the time you don't notice it. Right now your body knows all kinds of things.
Okay.
Yeah? Generally what you get is, you don't get the sense that your blood sugar level is dropping. All you get is suddenly you're hungry, you know. because your brain has shifted gears and said, oh, well, we're running low here, do something about it. Let's get his stomach to grumble, or let's bring some food images up in his inner mind, or, you know, let's give him... The brain has already reacted to the perception of dropping levels, but you don't generally notice that, you notice it at a very late stage. Suddenly, the angry, loud voice in the room, you notice it's me, actually. You know, you haven't noticed that you have gradually entered the state of anger. For example, please.
When fear rises, and I spot it early enough not to take hold.
Where do you spot it?
Heat.
Heat, where?
Probably all over, but maybe particularly around here. Particularly here, hands. But it's like a detection. It's like an act of detection.
And you said something else, namely that you, by noticing it, you then have a chance not to take it. Did I catch that correct?
Yes. It doesn't take hold.
Yeah.
I'm not left. No. There's no resistance.
Yeah.
It's just that spotting it means that it loses its grip on me.
Now that's interesting, isn't it? One would expect almost the opposite. One would expect, as long as I don't notice it, it's not really taking a foothold. But what you say is just the contrary, isn't it? By acknowledging or by naming it, I can actually stay out of it in some ways, isn't it? Now that's an interesting observation. It's counterintuitive, isn't it? You would think the things that I'm not aware of are the things that don't really hurt. I'm glad for that one. Thank you. Please.
I often see things. I mean, obviously the senses come more alive, but I see things. I can be sitting and then suddenly I see something in great detail, or I see something I've looked at every day, and then suddenly you think, I've never seen this thing before. Right. And, you know, and you see on something, you think, 25 years I've lived here.
Right.
Or you drive along a route you've driven along and you see a house you've never seen in your life before. You know, it's incredible. I find that quite amazing.
Right. I think that's a very beautiful example. That the senses come alive. Yeah. So that's one indication. Yeah. Obviously the reverse holds true as well. You know, if your life is more and more grey and more of a blur, and the things that gave you joy don't really give you joy, and then you notice something has obviously left you. Then it may be that you're living too much on the fast track or so. The sensory intensity, without seeking intensity particularly, sensory intensity or sensory perceptual novelty or so can often be an indication. I remember my teacher said the really after profound meditation experience, he didn't actually acknowledge that it happened, but when he looked at his shabby old plastic equipment, you know, his water bowl, and he looked at it and it was so stunningly beautiful. He realized something had transfigured him. Yeah, other voices.
I used to think when I was practicing, there wasn't really any role, that the idea was to try in a way to not have the mind be aware of it, and that it should just be about the feeling. And so I was constantly like, oh, not up here, and then like almost like there was just some weird, I couldn't, I don't know, that the feeling should just be here. And that what I now feel that I understand, if it seems right, is that it's there's the relationship between the two. So almost that you can be off somewhere, either in your life or if you're trying to concentrate on your breath and your mind's wandered, but that the initial is here, but then immediately after that I can just, okay, what's the feeling around this? And so it's a relationship between the two.
So they don't struggle anymore. You don't feel you need to have no thoughts to be a proper body,
yeah,
mindful meditator.
I just misunderstood what it was about.
Well, it sounds like you have actually understood. I think, you know, most of our understanding when we learn somewhere is partial.
Mm.
Yeah. So I think it sounds like you have actually understood something despite being told to be aware of the body, that actually there is something that is not body, that is aware. Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Very nice.
Mm-hmm.
But they're all good. I mean, there would be lots more, and you're a bit shy. That's what it seemed to me. Let's do something very simple. let me name some three simple stages of awareness. The first stage is when things pop up and you just go with them. Yeah. This is the kind of normal state. This is an untrained type of awareness. Something pops up, and generally the dominant thing that pops up gets the awareness. Yeah, it's the wheel that squeaks loudest gets the oil, basically. That's the principle. I sit here, I'm thinking of my future, anxiously trying to plan something, and then I hear a sound. The telephone rings. I think, is his mother? No, it's too early for mother. Better go and, you know, go and get it quick before the answer kicks in. I go over. Conversation is back. I come back, and I think there's an echo of my plan, what I wanted to plan, and there's an echo of the conversation, and some aspect of that conversation brings something to mind I have forgotten for 3 days, and then it goes this direction. That's the kind of normal, untrained, everyday awareness. It's not sati. It's just plain operative awareness, which helps me connect dots in my life more or less effectively, and it is not going to lead me to deep stillness of mind. It's also not going to lead me to deep insights. The next stage is I actually identify a task, and I notice when I'm veering off that task. Yeah, I notice that I'm no longer on track. I notice that I started off doing this and now I'm doing that. Again, I do this again, and then again. I begin to notice it goes when I bring it back. The next stage is I kind of stay with something. It changes, and I can stay with something. I think that is what you described. I stay with my body, and then I have a thought about the body sensation, and then I'm becoming aware that I'm thinking, and then I can go back to the body. I could pursue the thought. I could go into a big tirade, I shouldn't think. Problem, Kaya Nupassana meditation is feeling the body in the body rather than thinking about feeling the body in the body. And I could do that, but instead it just kind of poof, the energy goes out and you go back. And you can stay with the body, even though you have had a thought, the body hasn't gone away completely. It's there as the backdrop. Yeah. So the object you have chosen is there as the backdrop. You have established now a fluid type of awareness, which I would call is a good sati, you know, continual. That's where it starts to be powerful. We all have mindfulness. It's not something very lofty. It's not something very extraordinary. It's very everyday stuff. The magic thing about sati is when it stays, you know, when it becomes continual. That's where the magic starts. You wouldn't have made it here without sati, I can guarantee you. You wouldn't survive in London for a short, half an hour without sati. So you all have that. It's not something elevated that only gifted meditators can achieve. But it's fragmented often. It's co-opted by input. It's habituated. That's the problem with sati. So what we wish to disentangle it from its rigors. Yeah, we want to free it. We want to make it mobile. We want to make it self-aware. We want to be able to give it rather than have it seduced. The next stage, where it starts really getting interested, is if we have a space of awareness and when we can feel the quality of that space of awareness irrespective of the things that come and go within that space. Yeah. Up to the previous stage, sati was always connected with an object, with a process, with an event in my awareness, and sati was focused on that event, process, or thing. Now we have an awareness that is kind of has an open spatial quality, and it doesn't depend anymore on the things that come and go within that space. It's a different kind of quality. But all of these are aspects of sati, even the first distracted one, you know. We episodically attend to things and then are being dragged away by things that are more dominant. It works, you know. It works as a species, has worked as a species for us, and it works in our societies. It's not making us enlightened. It's often not making us happy. It's definitely way below what we can do, what we can experience. So it's worth optimizing. But it doesn't kill us, you know. There are many functions in our body work very well without us being aware. Your breath, for example. If you become aware of your breath, you become aware of lots of things. So if your mindfulness tells you where you're at, stop blaming yourself for not being where you think you should be. Welcome the message. You know, say, you bump in a corner with your elbow, welcome the message. You spill some water, welcome the message. Something says, obviously I'm not where I am. Obviously I'm not doing what I'm doing. Welcome the message. Decriminalize that whole thing. You're allowed to goof. You're allowed to not be perfect. You're allowed to be scatterbrained, distracted, uncoordinated. You have to give yourself permission to do that. Once you give yourself permission, when you notice that this happens, disappoint yourself. Sometimes you can do that very elegantly in meditation. You're kind of sort of dozing a little and then a bird whistles. The bird is technically a distraction, but actually it has helped you go back to your breath because it has made you aware that you were dozing. Yeah. So make use of these kind of pointers the universe gives you, where your awareness gets stuck or absorbs or hangs back. Yeah. Kind of to say, okay. be your friend. Identify with the good guy in here, yeah? not with the bad guy. You don't need to. If it's blaming, if it's judging, it's the bad guy. Okay, you're the good guy. So let those pointers bring you back to your task, bring you back to your exercise.